If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Marie Antoinette is a historical figure who's been much mythologized as callous, superficial, extravagant, and out of touch with reality. But if we go back to the original sources and examine her own letters, what kind of woman emerges? I spoke to Professor Catriona Seth from the University of Oxford to find out what the Queen of France's correspondence can tell us about her life and character, from her early years as a teenaged royal bride to her eventual downfall in the French Revolution. Marie Antoinette is a historical figure who I think has been much mythologized. We all know this pampered image of her in the humongous powdered wig saying, let them eat cake. But if we go back and we look at her letters, like you have done, does that offer a different perspective on the Queen of France?
I think looking at Marie Antoinette's letters gives us a very different perspective to what we might expect from the myth-making, the Hollywood image of the beautiful princess with the high hairstyles and the puffed-out dresses who's partying all day long, for instance, or the out-of-touch royal. When you read her letters, one of the interesting things, which we forget too often about Marie Antoinette, but also about a lot of other historical figures, is that she develops over time. The Marie Antoinette who arrives in France as a teenager when she's married to the heir to the King of France, and she arrives from Vienna, where she was born as an Austrian archduchess, is not the same person as the woman who in 1793 mounts the scaffold to be guillotined. And the advantage of her letters, which are spread throughout her existence, more or less, is to give us a much more diverse picture of her, both by what they say explicitly and by what they don't say.
And hopefully in this conversation, we'll touch on some of those milestones that you referred to there. But before we do, give us a sense of what Marie Antoinette's letters are like. What kind of things was she discussing in them?
The things Marie Antoinette discusses in her letters vary very much according to the period of her life. When she's writing to her mother as a young woman, I like to think of it a bit like what we used to do when we were made to write letters to our grandparents. So an account of what she's been up to, what court life is like, what she's been reading, answering any reproaches her mother may have formulated in earlier letters. So that's one type of correspondence, for instance, which she has. There are also very different letters which she writes when she's in prison or more or less imprisoned in the Tuileries, when the royal family is under house arrest during the revolution. And those are highly politicized secret letters where she's thinking about how you could fund a counter-revolution, how you could get some of the troops to mass on the borders and this sort of thing. So there's a very wide variety in the letters, and that's one of the fascinating points.
And what was she like as a letter writer? Was she an eloquent, witty letter writer, or did it not come so naturally to her?
Initially, Marie Antoinette, a bit like most teenagers, is a very reluctant letter writer. She initially doesn't like writing letters. It's not her natural way of proceeding. She's not intellectual. And so sitting down and writing isn't something which would come naturally to her in the way it would have done, for instance, to her late sister-in-law, Isabella of Parma, who was very much an intellectual and, you know, composed a lot of texts and that sort of thing. Towards the end of Marie Antoinette's life, to look at the revolutionary letters again, there Marie Antoinette is writing as soon as she can, whenever she has a spare moment, because it's her only means of action. So once again, I think there isn't a one-size-fits-all answer to that question.
And can you give us a sense of how important letter writing was in this period? What it was like as a form of communication?
Letter writing becomes particularly important during the 18th century in a country like France. If we look across all sorts of different areas of society, for a start, illiteracy rates are much lower than in previous centuries, so more people can write. Roads are improved, so there are better communications. You'll have regular mail coaches, and you'll know that if you, you know, post your letter in Paris, you know, on Wednesday, it'll be in Marseille on Saturday or whatever it happens to be. So there are a lot of elements like that which we might take for granted and which change the relationship people can have to letters. There's also something very noticeable during the period, which is that letters are not merely used as ways of communicating official information or business information. So there's much more ordinary correspondence, in a sense, personal correspondence, than there was in earlier centuries.
So I wonder if we could rewind a bit now and look at Marie Antoinette's early years as Queen of France. Can you tell us a bit about her early life and how she ended up in such an incredible position?
Marie Antoinette was born Maria Antonia, and she's an Austrian archduchess. So she's the daughter of Maria Theresa, who in her own right was Queen of Hungary and Bohemia, and Francis Stephen, who became the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So in modern terms, we'd say she's Austrian. That's a term we would use. Maria Theresa, Marie Antoinette's mother, was very interested in extending her network and doing this through her children. She had 16 of them, so that leaves rather a lot of children to think about marrying, even though a number of them died when they were young. And so she tries to make matches for her children which will strengthen her political position, strengthen her network. And Marie Antoinette, her last daughter, her last but one child, is the one who has the most prestigious place because she marries the heir to the King of France. And Marie Antoinette will become Queen of France, and she will end up, as her mother says, in the place for which God intended her. That's very much Maria Theresa's take on life. Maria Theresa wanted this particular alliance concluded because there had been a geopolitical upheaval just after the birth of the Archduchess who would become Marie Antoinette, when Austria and France had sided with each other against Prussia and England, whereas you'd have expected other types of alliances. And that's important because it means that whilst for Marie Antoinette, the union between France and Austria was a natural, it was not necessarily seen as natural by all her contemporaries. There were still a lot of people in Austria who would see France as the enemy, and more importantly for Marie Antoinette, in France, who continued to see Austria and anyone who represented Austria as the enemy. So when Marie Antoinette arrives as the wife of the future King of France, she does come in with that negative perception by a certain number of people because she represents a traditional enemy of France.
And do we have any idea how she found this transition to life in France? Do her letters reveal much about that?
The letters reveal things in what they say, but also in what they don't say. Marie Antoinette at this stage is essentially only writing to her mother. She's a teenager. She speaks French fluently because French is one of the court languages in Austria, so that's not a problem. But in a sense, everything else is. She's been married to a teenager who isn't interested in her, so the marriage won't be consummated for a number of years. She's ended up in a court which is very different to the Viennese court. It's a court, for instance, where you're on show all the time or nearly. When Marie Antoinette arrives in Versailles, all eyes are on her. And they're on her even more so because there is no Queen of France at that stage, since the reigning monarch, Louis XV, is a widower. And so no Queen of France, but shockingly enough, he has a mistress. And he has a mistress who is very present at court. And Marie Antoinette has been brought up by a very Catholic mother and doesn't understand why, on the one hand, she's being, you know, told that it's not on to have mistresses, and on the other, she's being expected to pay some attention to this woman who has no official status. So it's a bit of a minefield.
This division you talked about there between public and private is really interesting. Can we take Marie Antoinette's letters as an expression of her private feelings and her private thoughts? Or was there an understanding that they would be read and it wasn't really a private form of communication?
I think that's a very good question, to which the answer is not one I can give simply. Marie Antoinette, when she writes letters, I think, you know, pours out her heart. She's somebody who's very direct. If she says something, on the whole, she means it. And she doesn't realise, I think, the extent to which some of her letters are passed around or are looked at. And that includes the letters she writes to her mother, which the Austrian ambassador will look at, and on which the Austrian ambassador sometimes will send comments to the Chancellor or copy bits out. And in that respect, I think she's almost too trusting in her letters, and indeed very much in her personal life too. And in that respect, I think that particular expression of the public-private divide is one which puts its finger on something Marie Antoinette suffers through during her lifetime. She would very much like to distinguish the public and the private, and she doesn't always manage to because external circumstances don't always allow her to.
What else in these early years of her queenship and her time in France do her letters reveal about her character? You suggested that maybe she was fairly naive. Obviously, she was young when she first arrived there. But what else can we tell about what she was like as a person?
Again, she's very frank. She's looking for friendship. She wants affection. She, you know, is trying to please. Something quite striking. And we know that also from people who wrote diaries at the time or other people who wrote letters about her. She's very spontaneous in many ways. She's naturally quite kind. She's quite tactful. But she's also, and I think it goes together to a certain extent, she's not wily at all. Therefore, she's naive. And so in some ways, things which should have been arguments in her favour in the eyes of most people sometimes play against her because she doesn't necessarily measure the consequences of her actions. For instance, if she's very enthusiastic about a new person she's met and just thinks, oh, this person is very nice and spontaneous and lovely and I get on with them, she doesn't realise that the whole of court is thinking about, you know, well, why should X be a friend of the Queen? Or, you know, sort of, is the Queen granting undue favour to Y and so on?
What were some of the rumours and the gossip that swirled around Marie Antoinette?
The gossip starts quite early, and the gossip starts essentially because Marie Antoinette and the future Louis XVI take 7 years to consummate their marriage. And of course, Marie Antoinette has been married to the heir to the throne of France quite simply because the throne of France needs heirs. And so her one role in life is to produce heirs, and nothing is happening at that end. And there is a lot of gossip at court because people are, you know, spying on Marie Antoinette and her husband continuously, and, you know, wondering whether they spend time together or not, noting that, you know, the king likes to go out hunting, whereas the queen likes to go out partying. He gets up early, she goes to bed late, and this sort of thing, and trying to show that in many ways it seems that they're very incompatible in what they do and enjoy. A lot of the gossip comes from the apparent mismatch between what Marie Antoinette is being asked to do and what she appears to be performing as a role. So there are lots of early rumours which start in court circles. There's lots of gossip saying, well, clearly, you know, the king isn't doing what he should be doing and getting her pregnant. And this probably means that she's doing something else. Maybe she's having it off with somebody else. And so there are all sorts of rumours like that, which are untrue, but which are ways of painting Louis XVI as weak, and Marie Antoinette as someone who wants to wear the trousers in the royal household. And that's all the more the case because Marie Antoinette is seen as a sort of second Maria Theresa in some ways. Her mother was a very powerful figure in political terms. And when Maria Theresa's daughters are thought of by the public at large, they assume that these young women will be like their mother.
The most famous anecdote that's gone down in history, it's obviously not true, is of course that Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. And to me, what that shows is that there was an image of her as callous and out of touch with reality. Is that reflected in the sources that you've been looking at in terms of her letters?
I don't think she's ever callous. And there are examples of her being extremely generous and kind. But I do think that when she's young, certainly she is out of touch with reality. She, you know, she doesn't really understand what's going on. And quite frankly, if you're a 15-year-old and sent, you know, halfway across Europe to live with people you'd never met and marry a man who was totally uninterested in you, you'd want all the friends you could get, and you'd want to be partying all the time or having pretty new dresses or whatever. So there's, I think, some truth to the vision of Marie Antoinette as, you know, somewhat flighty, airhead, not interested in weighty conversations and this sort of thing when she's a young woman. But I wouldn't judge her because of that. I don't think it's something which holds true throughout her life.
And if we move forward into a much more turbulent part of Marie Antoinette's life, the French Revolution, what do we see happening in the letters that she's sending? How do they change?
The letters change enormously during the revolution, because Marie Antoinette is trying to resolve the political problems of France. She's living in a country to which her son is the heir. She very much, she says it several times, and she says it all the way through to her trial. She wants France to be happy. She talks about wanting the happiness of France, le bonheur de la France. And she believes that France as a stable monarchy is the way forward. And so she wants to help to regain that form of balance, in a sense. And in order to do so, she tries to count on different people who might help her, both within France and beyond the borders. And she's writing to, you know, members of various royal houses, for instance, or other political figures, in order to try and achieve this.
So is it fair to say that she became much more politically aware in these later years, perhaps out of necessity?
I think that's absolutely true. Marie Antoinette starts to become more and more politically aware over time. And before the revolution, she's already aware of things going on. And throughout, she's wanted stability throughout. And one of the things which is very clear is that even before the revolution, for instance, if the Austrians are asking her to do something, you know, to intervene and suggest a name for a diplomatic position or something like that, she will always say, you know, what's best for France? Her ideal is for France and Austria to get on, but she knows that the only thing that she can really push for is something which can be for the greater good of France. And that's what she's going to be pursuing throughout. And she's going to be pursuing it, becoming more and more involved and also manipulating more and more complicated concepts and ideas, thinking about, for instance, whether an international congress would be a useful way of discussing the geopolitical situation and so on. And, you know, if you'd asked the 15-year-old Marie-Antoinette about, you know, what the importance of congresses was, I think, you know, like most 15-year-olds, she'd have been stumped if you'd asked her to come up with a clever answer.
How challenging was it in this era, the French Revolutionary era, for Marie-Antoinette to send out these letters? Because I would presume that revolutionaries wouldn't want her appealing to foreign powers for assistance. So what tricks did she have to use to get her letter sent?
The royal family moves from Versailles, which is where they lived, to Paris in October 1789, when the mob has stormed the palace and indeed tried to attack Marie-Antoinette specifically. They're escorted to Paris, where they take up living quarters in the Tuileries, which is another royal residence, but not one in which the king and queen traditionally lived. So they've been forced to live in Paris. And initially, they managed to get a sort of simulacrum of court life together. So there are court receptions, you know, ambassadors will come, there are balls and, you know, card games, and they go to the theatre and the opera and this sort of thing. And at various stages, things get tougher and tougher, and surveillance increases. And in particular, the revolutionaries, you're right, wouldn't want anybody to be corresponding with their enemies. And increasingly, of course, someone like Marie-Antoinette's brother, the emperor, will be seen as an enemy of France. And so she, on the one hand, could be writing a personal letter to her brother, but on the other hand, could also be writing a political letter to the leader of an enemy country. And that, I think, is something which she plays on to a certain extent. And during the time when Marie-Antoinette is in the Tuileries under very intense scrutiny of those around her, she has all sorts of ways of communicating safely. One of the things she does is that she entrusts letters to designated bearers, so she will get someone whom she trusts to take a letter. It won't be sent through normal sort of postal circuits. But she also uses a lot of codes. She gets good at cryptography. And one of the means there is doing that is something I think a lot of us played with when we were young, and that is writing in things like lemon juice. You know, you write in lemon juice and then you put the piece of paper near a flame and miraculously the letters shine through. That's almost a spy trick for beginners. Well, she does that. But she also uses some quite clever codes with code words which change for each letter. And the way in which that works is you will use one particular word as the sort of master word for your code. And how do you agree on the word? Well, both you and the person to whom you're writing have the same book in the same edition. And what you will do is on the top of your letter, you'll write a number. So you'll write number 52. And number 52 means that when I get the letter you've written to me, which says number 52, I go to page 52 of the book, I look at the first word of the book, and whatever that first word is, that's the word I will use in order to create my code. And that's how I will be able to sort of reverse engineer the coding and work out what you've actually said. So there's a lot of that going on. There's also some allusions. So, you know, you'll talk about the person who was unwell, and that might mean France rather than a real person. Or there are ways of making papers look as though they're not actually letters. So, you know, using them as lining paper in a box or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of sort of spy tricks that you might think of in sort of teenage spy novels nowadays.
Yeah, clever stuff. Obviously, we know that ultimately Marie Antoinette was not able to engineer her own escape. Did she come close at all?
I think there were stages where it would have been possible for things to happen differently. One of them, of course, is the failed escape attempt, which sees the royal family arrested in the east of France at Varennes. That had been quite cleverly thought through. And Marie-Antoinette, Louis XVI, and their children were disguised as members of different families. So Marie-Antoinette was disguised as the governess, and her little boy was disguised as a girl, so it looks like they had two daughters rather than one, and so on, and they had passports belonging to other people. They travelled in a very heavy coach, which was stopped, and it was stopped when it had already been worked out that the royal family had escaped from Paris during the night, and that was why they ended up being caught. But I think that could have gone differently. They, you know, they could have got through, they could have escaped had things not gone that way. There were other times, for instance, at the end of Marie Antoinette's life, after the king had been executed in January, Marie Antoinette was taken from the Temple prison where she'd been with her children and previously her husband. She was taken to the conciergerie where she was kept in solitary confinement. And there were attempts then also to help her escape. So it is imaginable. It was also not a foregone conclusion that Marie Antoinette would be executed. If we think back to the role of the Queen of France, even nowadays, France isn't very good at giving women a place in politics. And in Marie Antoinette's day, the only role for the Queen of France is to be the consort and to produce children. And then possibly, but this had been ruled out for Marie Antoinette by the revolutionaries, possibly being the regent if their son was an orphan before they were old enough to become the king. So the queen has absolutely no political role, no political power. It's very telling if you look at pictures of the coronation of Louis XVI. Marie Antoinette is among the spectators sitting, you know, on the balcony and not at all in this very male ceremony where the king is being crowned. And in that respect, the revolutionaries didn't need to execute her because executing the king was one thing, because by executing the king, they were stopping a political regime. They were beheading the regime, in a sense, and not just beheading the individual. Marie Antoinette didn't represent anything. She was, you know, just the king's wife. And if we think to another case, not very far down the line, that of Emperor Napoleon III, who was deposed, his wife, Empress Eugénie, was allowed to live in exile to the end of her days, you know, and died in her bed. And it could quite easily have happened to Marie Antoinette. Her marriage contract said that, you know, if she was widowed, she could go back to Austria. So one could quite easily have imagined something like that. And it didn't happen. So in that respect, I don't think it was a foregone conclusion that she'd be executed. And I think she was executed because the climate was so appalling in France at the time that there needed to be ways of uniting some of the revolutionary factions. And by executing Marie Antoinette, by, you know, putting a hated symbol to death, the idea was that that would create a bond between different factions.
That idea of it not being a foregone conclusion is really interesting. In Marie Antoinette's final letters, do we get a sense that she ever knew what her fate was going to be? Did she believe she would die, or did she think that there was a way out until the very end?
Marie Antoinette is very much convinced at different stages during the time when she's in Paris that she will die. And the extraordinary thing is that when she refers to the fact that, you know, she might die, she never wants to be taken away from her family. So the idea that she could be exfiltrated at one point, you know, because she's Austrian and taken back to Austria, you know, she doesn't contemplate it for an instant because her child is the future King of France and her place is by her husband's side and by her son's side. And I think that her consciousness of her fate is something which gives her an occasion to show the depth of her character, which we don't necessarily notice. Because if you read the letters that she's writing, for instance, to Mercy, the Austrian ambassador, when she's imprisoned in the Tuileries, she writes and says, you know, I have to make sure that, you know, I live up to my mother's reputation. Her blood runs in my son's veins. And, you know, we all of us need to make sure that we live up to this inheritance. And in that respect, I think she's courageous in her approach. And whilst she clearly, as anyone would, hoped that things would end happily, she indubitably contemplated the fact that she might be executed or, you know, put to death some other way.
And do we know what her final letter was?
There is some doubt as to her final letter. There are different elements of final letters. What's thought to be her final letter is a long letter to her sister-in-law and children, where it's referred to in French as the testament de Marie Antoinette, so Marie Antoinette's sort of last will and testament type of thing. And she says that she doesn't want her children to try and avenge her death and that of their father. And, you know, she has a fairly forgiving tone, but it's a very sort of noble and long letter. And then there's a very tiny little note in a prayer book, which she apparently wrote in just before she was taken off to be executed. And when she says, you know, my poor children, you know, may God be merciful towards you. I have no more tears for you. And which is a, you know, very moving few lines. So you can take either one of those as her last letter.
After spending all this time looking at Marie Antoinette's letters, how do you think that we should remember her today?
I think one of the things we need to do is look at all her letters and look at the letters of people who encountered her and try and strip away the myth. So I don't mean that, we shouldn't have haute couture collections with beautiful dresses which are inspired by some of the stunning portraits of Marie Antoinette. I think that's great. But I do believe that we have a duty to a certain extent to historical figures to try and paint them as accurately as we can. And that currently a lot of what we think we know about Marie Antoinette, or a lot of the ideas peddled about Marie Antoinette, are rumours, are myth, and are standing in the way of us getting a more balanced approach, not only of her, but also of a whole period. And I think part of it is tied to the fact that she's a woman and that she was objectified, and, you know, possibly with a more sort of women-friendly vision of history, characters like Marie Antoinette will be seen sort of in their own words and for what they were, rather more than through a somewhat skewed narrative.
That was Catriona Seth. You can find a feature that she wrote for BBC History magazine on this subject by searching for Marie Antoinette at historyextra.com. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.